Insurance v. Spaulding Enterprises. Mr. Barnes.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is James Barnes, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, LM Insurance Corporation. The plaintiff seeks reversal of the trial court's determination that the $185,000 debt owed to the plaintiff in consequence of a prior lawsuit did not constitute the cause and controversy amount in this case. The trial court's decision was premised on the belief that plaintiff cannot bring a new case to recover a debt from a prior case. The trial court's decision was unsupported by any law and was in error, as you can bring a new case to collect a debt on a prior case. In this manner, the debt owed approximately $185,000 is the outstanding amount from a judgment in a prior case. The $185,000 clearly satisfies the jurisdictional minimum requirement under 28 U.S.C., and therefore the trial court's dismissal for want of diversity jurisdiction based on cause and controversy amount was an error. Considering first and foremost plaintiff's rollover claims, plaintiff has brought an alter ego count. Like any alter ego count, the plaintiff seeks to hold certain entities and individuals responsible for a prior debt. In this case, the prior debt is the $185,000, and therefore the cause and controversy has been met. In its brief, plaintiff cited to Petome, Pizos, Drexel, Grable, and Sealand Services, all in support of its position. And none of those cases were addressed, distinguished, or rebutted in the defendant's brief. Likewise, if successor liability means anything, it means that one is holding a successor entity liable for the debt of a predecessor. In this case, that debt is $185,000, which clearly satisfies the cause and controversy minimum requirement.
Would they say this whole thing that went all the way through to Spaulding Trucking that was only $5,000 ultimately, just in view of that, do you know what, for example, for I think it was for the receivables where Amcor Bank, was it, bought?
Yes, Judge.
How much did they pay for those? Is that in the record?
I'm not sure. I believe there was some, the value of them minus some percentage. I want to say 12%.
Face value is $150,000. What did they actually discount that when they sold it?
I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 10%, Judge, but I'm not sure.
All right, so that would be about $15,000. Because I assume what's going on here is that the reason the individuals are charged is because they, in fact, drained or didn't have a marketable sale or something or other that they stripped the corporation, so therefore it doesn't have anything left. I guess there would be some sort of an abuse.
Yes, Judge.
And so individually, maybe they would be liable for that diminution and therefore would be continually obligated somehow for the judgment.
Yes.
That's what I'm just trying to clear up, that there are numbers here.
Their argument seems to be that the asset sale, whatever that number is what's determinative of this matter. I don't agree with that or the court's reasoning, but I respectfully acknowledge with counts 1 through 3, the fiduciary duties, there's certainly a rational basis. But on the remaining counts, rollover counts, fraud counts, it is the amount that will make plaintiff whole on the date they file their complaint that constitutes the cause and controversy amount. That number is $185,000. And indeed, Judge, it could not be any other number. For example, if the asset sale, the transfer of assets, was $5 million, could I bring a claim demanding $5 million? That would clearly be a Rule 11 issue. Frivolous. There's no basis in the law. So what is the basis in the law that allows me to bring an alter ego claim? It is for debt owed to me, the recognizable harm done to the plaintiff. That is derived from a judgment of $185,000. As to the fraud counts, now, through the rollover counts, plaintiff establishes jurisdiction, because plaintiff only needs to establish jurisdiction once to have jurisdiction on the entire case. The rollover counts give plaintiff jurisdiction on Spalding Enterprises, Spalding Trucking, Spalding Moving, John Lalagos, and Gene Lalagos. Plaintiff has jurisdiction over the three remaining defendants, Rally Capital, Trustee Jeffrey Samuels, and Lawyer Rosetti, based on its fraud claims. The plaintiff alleges all of the defendants placed plaintiff's judgment outside of plaintiff's reach. They all aided and abetted in the fraudulent scheme. They therefore must answer for same. Based on law quoted in our brief, the measure for damages is the loss suffered to the plaintiff, not the gain to defendant. In this case, that figure is the judgment which was fraudulently laundered in the amount of approximately $185,000. To a certain extent, defendants are attempting to or inviting the court to adjudicate on the merits. On a motion to dismiss for cause and controversy, the trial court's decision should only be sustained if it would be legally impossible for plaintiff to prevail. Defendants may well, and to a certain extent I think in the briefs are arguing, that plaintiff's complaint will fail, that there's no merit or that they'll lose. I don't believe that, but assuming arguendo, all of that is true. None of that has anything to do with cause and controversy amount. Plaintiff has pled a specific number in its complaint consistently, $185,000. That satisfies the cause and controversy requirement. I believe the trial court's opinion essentially said to the plaintiff, your remedy is to go back to your prior case and the supplemental proceedings and pursue those. There's no basis in the law for that belief. And perhaps more to the point, in Paisos, the Illinois court has explicitly said you may not pursue a piercing the corporate veil, i.e. alter ego action, in supplemental proceedings. Instead, you may file a new action to pursue that remedy. That is precisely what the plaintiff did. We reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. I thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Mr. Valenti.
Morning, Counsel, Your Honors. Judge, I'm here, Charles Valenti, I'm here on behalf of Rally Capital Services and Jeffrey Samuels. For convenience, I'll refer to them as Rally. I think the problem that counsel is ignoring in this case is that this court has firmly set down as precedent that when you have a diversity case, the district court and all the parties presume that the allegation that there's more than $75,000 in controversy to be true, until the defendants come forward with proof that demonstrate that that amount is not in controversy. And that's precisely what we did here. They alleged that there was $150,000 in controversy because that was the amount of accounts receivable that allegedly were moved beyond their ability to collect because through their judgment. We came forward with proof that demonstrated that, in fact, the accounts receivable at most could have totaled approximately $20,000. Obviously, $55,000 short of the amount in controversy. At that point, we've met a burden of production. It then became incumbent upon the plaintiff to come forward with evidence, put evidence in the record that demonstrated the possibility of recovering in excess of $75,000. This plaintiff failed to do so. Plaintiff wants the court to believe that because it has a judgment of approximately $185,000 unsatisfied, that's the amount in controversy. Counsel argues that based on these fraud counts, somehow my clients could be liable for the $185,000. The measure of damages for fraud in Illinois is that the defrauded party should be placed in the same position he would have been in had the fraud not occurred. In other words, because the fraud that's alleged here was my client's participation in assignment for benefit of creditors as the assignee, allowing assets of Spalding Enterprises to be moved to Spalding Trucking, and allegedly beyond the reach of their judgment, if that had not occurred, what would they have gotten? Well, we've set forth proof that they would have gotten approximately $20,000 in accounts receivable at most. They have come forward with no proof that they would have recovered one dime more. They haven't come forward with any proof as to any other asset that Spalding Enterprises had or the value of that asset, and they haven't come forward with any proof that they would have collected any dollars on their judgment beyond the accounts receivable that could have been available, $20,000.
Your Honor, does that have to be now? That I guess the whole question here is whether or not they sufficiently stated a claim or whatever to meet the jurisdictional limit. A lot of what you say may make the, once the case, if it were accepted, might fall in a hurry. But I wonder, is it at this stage of the game, is it fair to say, well, they can't win, so they shouldn't have jurisdiction?
I'm not saying they can't win, Your Honor. I don't believe they can win the case ultimately, but I'm not saying they can't win. I'm saying there's no evidence, they've come forward with no evidence that demonstrating a possibility of recovering in excess of $75,000. If they had come forward with some evidence on that, we have a different story. But they haven't. We've come forward with evidence that shows the most they recover is $20,000. They need evidence, not speculation, evidence that they could recover more than that. That was their burden to meet here. With respect to the fact that this came up on a motion to dismiss, they had the ability to seek discovery from the district court. They chose not to for whatever reason. At this point, they can't be heard to complain about their failure to seek discovery on the issue. So in the absence of evidence that they cover more than $75,000, there's no dispute that a federal court can entertain. They want to go to state court on this, they're certainly free to do so. But it's beyond... It's beyond the jurisdiction of the federal courts.
Lenny, do you want to touch on possibility of punitives?
Yes, I will, Your Honor, briefly. They claim, with respect to count one, the claim for breach of fiduciary duty, that they have stated a claim that allows, in the abstract, the award of punitive damages, and therefore they're entitled, therefore this court should assume they will recover enough to carry them over the hump. Well, they do so totally ignoring this court's decision in Anthony v. Security Pacific, which we discussed at length in our brief at page 21 through 23, I believe. Security Pacific recognized that same rule, but stated that where the amount in controversy, where the bulk of the amount in controversy had to be satisfied by punitive damages, the federal district court had to closely scrutinize the claim for punitive damages to determine whether, in fact, it could be met.
Did that analysis occur here?
Yes, I believe it did, Your Honor. I think the court did so. He may not have gone on for pages and pages about it, but in this particular case, the claim that was asserted is a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, not a claim for stealing breach of fiduciary duty, but essentially, when read fairly, the claim was that my client did a bad job in exercising its fiduciary duty to the creditors and therefore deprived them of assets. That's not the type of claim that would allow punitive damages. Now, the Anthony case says that you need to have some evidence of malice, willfulness, egregiousness under Illinois law to allow for the recovery of punitive damages. And once again, this plaintiff failed to come forward with any evidence to justify the award of punitive damages. I see that my red light is on, Your Honor, so just briefly to sum up, we would ask that with respect to my clients, on counts 1, 7, and 8, there is no basis for federal jurisdiction, and we would ask that the court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Valenti. Mr. Arducci?
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, I represent John and Jean Lagos, Spalding Enterprises, and Spalding Moving and Storage. With me is Jim Gendon, who represents Spalding Trucking, and Ms. Rossetti, but I'm going to speak on behalf of both of us.
I think that Mr. Valenti, in his briefs and in his comments this morning, have addressed the counts that are common to the defendants, and those are either common or have common issues. Counts 2, 3, and 4, I think L&M lumps them together, the plaintiff lumps them together, and I think they all clearly relate to the assignment for the benefit of creditors and thus are limited to the amount that was in play in that assignment, which the evidence has shown was far less than the jurisdictional amount. Counts 7 and 8 are the fraud claims, and those also, I think the fraud that's alleged clearly was fraud in making the assignment for the benefit of creditors, and Mr. Valenti has also addressed those. I'd like to focus on the two counts that are unique to the what I'll call the Spalding parties, and that is counts 5 and 6. Count 5 is a count for successor liability against Spalding Trucking, and count 6 is an alter ego claim against the Spalding companies and John and Jean Lalagos individually. Now, the appellant attempts to argue that the jurisdictional amounts for these counts are not constrained by the amount of the assets that were transferred pursuant to the assignment for the benefit of creditors. However, this is not consistent with the position that the plaintiff took in the court below. In the jurisdictional statement that plaintiff's counsel filed in the court below, and this is quoted on pages 10 and 11 of our brief, he stated that each of the referenced defendants, and that is Spalding Enterprises, Spalding Moving and Storage, and John and Jean Lalagos, are named in one or more of the following counts: fraudulent conveyance, count 4, successor liability, count 5, or alter ego, count 6. In turn, each of those counts directly relate to Spalding Enterprises' fraudulent rollover of its business operations in order to avoid the balance owing on its judgment to LM. So these were stated to all relate to the movement of the assets from Enterprises to Trucking in the course of the assignment for benefit of creditors. Based on that, the trial court correctly held that, and this is a quote, LM is solely seeking to vindicate its harm caused by the alleged fraudulent concealment and transfer of its assets, and it is the amount involved in such matters that is relevant for the amount in controversy requirement in this case. So the point here is, which I think the district court correctly recognized, this whole case is about the assignment for the benefit of creditors, which plaintiffs maintain was conducted improperly. And the as Mr. Valenti has pointed out, once the defendants have challenged the jurisdictional amount, it is incumbent upon the plaintiffs then to come forward with evidence to show that the jurisdictional amount is met. And that was held by this case in the NLFC case. The plaintiff has not done that here as to any of the counts. The proposition that a new case can be brought to collect a debt in a prior case, we characterize that argument as not being one that was raised with the court below, and plaintiff's counsel disputed that. I think that if you read the memorandum in opposition to the motion to dismiss below, you won't see these cases that counsel is talking about here this morning. Certainly, it's not disputed that at places in the lower court papers, plaintiffs did say they were entitled to the whole amount of the judgment. No question about that. But they did not argue that as a legal matter to the court below. They didn't cite any authority on that, and the lower court didn't have an opportunity to rule on that question. So I do think our position on that is correct. This action is premised on the proposition that the transfer of assets pursuant to the assignment for the benefit of creditors was incorrect. The entire action is based on that premise, and the evidence below showed that at most the amount involved in that transaction that could conceivably be recovered by the plaintiff is at most $20,000. It may not even be that. Based on that, we respectfully request that the judgment below be affirmed. Thank you, Mr. Ducey. Mr. Barnes.
Your Honors, our evidence is not the transfer of assets, at least with respect to counts 4, 5, and 6, the rollover counts, and 7 and 8, the fraud counts. Our evidence is the prior judgment debt of $185,000. There is an element here, respectfully, And I say that it's my case. And it's my number unless it's legally impossible, which means a contractual cap, a statutory prohibition, double counting. My number is real. If defendants are correct to the merits of my case, that is another matter. But it does not address my right to have satisfied diversity jurisdiction. Count 1 through 3 is very interesting. Certainly there is the whole element of punitive damages. But as I need to satisfy only once for each defendant, I have obviously concentrated on my rollover counts and my fraud counts. Lincoln National, in our reference to our brief, clearly stands for the proposition of how we're pursuing on the fraud. It's a very similar case, both to the measure of damages and from a prior corporation to a new corporation, who can be held liable for that measure of damages and the law applicable to it. I think the pleadings speak to whether or not we've raised this argument before the trial court. But their brief for motion to dismiss referenced two cases. We referenced 12 cases. Amongst those we referenced were Johnson v. Wattenberger, Gaspy Air Force, and Fulcrum Financial Advisors. As I said earlier today, Fulcrum Financial Advisors stands for a proposition that the cause in controversy is whatever is required to satisfy the plaintiff's demand in full on the date the plaintiff files suit. That number in this case specifically set forth in our complaint is the number of $185,000. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will...